This is the non-classical forensics talk, You Are What You Type. Over the next hour, I'm going to go over briefly what some classical investigative sciences are and how they work and how they interact with computer science. Then I'm going to dive in deep on some non-classical approaches and how they work with investigative techniques. And if I have time, I'll wrap up with a brief mention of some approaches that just don't quite work. I think they're working on the screen. Are they working on the screen? Lots of room over here. Classical investigative sciences are things that have been around for quite a while. They're time-tested, and they've been proven in a court of law. When people think of investigative sciences, they usually think of forensics and profiling. And they use the terms interchangeably. Forensics are the raw analysis of, and supposed to be unbiased, of information. So you can determine things like this item exists or this location contains. The thing about forensics is it is provable and repeatable. And if there's multiple approaches for determining the same type of analysis, then the different approaches should generate the same type of results. Profiling, on the other hand, interprets the forensic analysis. It allows you to create conjectures and estimates. And it's usually probabilistic. So you can say things like, he is likely, or I'm 80% confident that. Profiling allows you to answer questions like, are there patterns? Why was he doing that? And what are some physical or personal attributes that can be expected when you find the person? To give you a couple of examples, fingerprints are an example of forensics. Fingerprints have been known to be unique for over 3,000 years, and they were first used to solve crimes in about 100 years ago. What a fingerprint does is it matches a person to a location or an object. So a fingerprint on a smoking gun doesn't mean that the person pulled the trigger. It means that the person's hand touched the gun. Blood splatter, on the other hand, is a type of profiling. You show a criminologist a room with blood splatter in it, and they can tell you everything. The distribution of the blood can tell you the location where something happened. The shape of the blood drops can show you direction, movement. If there's blurs or smears or gaps, you can tell that something was moved around in there. The quantity of the blood can be used to estimate the type of wound. And the tackiness, the stickiness of the blood, can actually be used to determine when it was shed because blood dries at a fairly consistent rate. And that's just the beginning. Blood contains a wealth of information. Now, if you're into this type of physical forensics, I strongly recommend the book Forensics for Dummies. It's a great introductory book. But being here at Black Hat, we're more interested in computer science. And the modern computer hasn't been around for 50 years. So there's not that many techniques that are currently available. The ones that are primarily focused on system or network analysis. And that means that there's a little problem. You see, if you don't have access to the network, or if you don't have access to the system, then you can't do the analysis. You can't run the coroner's toolkit on a hard drive if you don't have a copy of the hard drive. And then there's network protocols that can modify data as they spread it. Peer-to-peer, net news, email. You're not actually looking at the original data. You're looking at a slightly modified copy of it. And there's problems with dynamic data. Things on the web can be here today, but not tomorrow. And network traffic only exists as long as the electrons are going across the wire. The collection points where storage happens are on the endpoints where the computers are. And even sniffer tools don't collect everything that they need. TCP dump is a good example. It associates a timestamp with a packet, but is that timestamp when the first bit arrived or when the last bit arrived, or is it some arbitrary time after it was received? The problem gets worse when you only have data. No timestamps, no relationships, and no owners. Then what? That's where non-classical forensics come in. For the last 9 years, I've been working on different types of anti-anonymity technology. The whole assumption is that you don't have access to the original system and you don't have access to the originating network traffic. The goal is to get anything you can. While it may not be useful at the end to actually identify someone, you don't know that at the time. And frankly, any information is better than no information. So I'm going to show you a couple of techniques to determine things like gender, nationality, whether someone's left or right-handed, and the type of keyboard that they're using. So to dive into gender determination, Back in 2003, a group of researchers came up with a novel approach for identifying the gender of an author. What they did was they looked at how people write, and what they found is that women use different words than men. Women, for example, prefer pronouns. Men prefer proper nouns. Women prefer adjectives. Men prefer adverbs, that sort of thing. And by determining the weight of whether there's more adverbs or more adjectives and that sort of thing, you could determine whether or not an article or a writing sample was made by a male or a female. What they also found is that people write differently in different genres. A male writing fiction will use different words than the same male writing nonfiction. A group of people at the book blog really liked this idea, and they created a system called the Gender Genie. It's a simplified version of the original algorithm that just uses a couple of words and a couple of weights, and what they did was they applied it to fiction, nonfiction, and blog-style text. I elaborated a lot of work on the Gender Genie and found that there's really only two different types of categories, formal writing and informal writing. So to give you now, when I say that there's only a couple of words and weights, I'm not kidding. This is all of them. That's it. A negative score means the word's more likely to be used by a female. A positive score means the score is more likely to be used by a male. So if I'm sitting in a blog chat room, or if I'm sitting in a chat room, and I see someone use the word actually, then the person's probably more likely to be female. If they use the word some, they're more likely to be male. Now, these words are not exclusive. A guy can actually use the word actually a lot of times, and still test out as being a guy. To give you an example of how this actually works, here's a paragraph out of the Black Hat 2004 Call for Papers. Since the Call for Papers is a formal writing style, we're going to throw out every word that was not in our formal word list, and what we're left with are a couple of words with weights. And then we just add them up. The word and appears 3 times and has a score of -4 for a total value of -12. The word the appears 6 times for a value of 7, total value of 42. And when you sum it all up, you come out with a positive value, indicating that the author was likely male. Now, I'd feel really stupid getting up here and saying that it was written by a guy, only to find out that it wasn't. So I sent off an email to the conference administrator asking who actually wrote this paragraph. The response came from someone named Ping Look. And Ping said, well, it's been a long time and a lot of people have touched it. The original text was written by Jeff. I modified it when I came on board and 2 other females have edited it since, so yes, it was written by a male. Great, this is validation. It's also another writing sample. Ping writes like a female. For those of you who have not met Ping, she was working out at the registration desk this morning. Now, this algorithm has a couple of limitations. Like, it's only, it's very simple. It's only 60 to 70% accurate, which is better than random guessing, but it's certainly not authoritative. And different genres use different writing styles. So a guy may write a paragraph and have it test as male for formal writing, but informal for female for informal writing. Other types of writing, like lists, like a top 10 list of things I don't like, poems, prose, lyrics, that sort of thing, are a completely different writing style. And so this system really doesn't work well with it. And email can add confusion because it can be formal and informal at the same time. And informal email from your boss can have traces of formality in it. And then there's lots of other factors, like if there's block quotes or copy editors, then you're probably testing words created by someone else. The author's familiarity, their age, nationality, experience, occupation, education, all of that can impact someone's writing style, and this system doesn't take it into account. There's also problems with weak matches, where the difference between the male scores and the female scores is not significant. When this happens, it means one of a couple of things. It could mean that the writing sample is just too small. It could mean that there's too many authors and different people are canceling out each other's weights. Or it could mean that the person's using something like European English. You see, Americans have a very small vocabulary compared to Europeans. The average American has about 20,000 words, whereas the average European adult male has about 75,000 words. Since this system relies on repetition, if you have more words to choose from, you're less likely to repeat the same words, and that gives a weak score. So now that we know how it works, we can start having some fun. MySpace hosts blogs, and blogs are an informal writing style. So I downloaded 3,400 blog web pages from MySpace and tried to test them. Now, at MySpace, you're actually allowed to declare whether you are male or female, and the declaration was a roughly 60-40 split. When I tested them, what I found is that most people who claim to be male write like males. What was, if you notice down at the bottom, that there are 4% of people, 123 blog entries, that actually tested as being female. Every one of those instances was either someone including lyrics or poetry or a top 10 list of things, things that the system should fail on. Then I tested the people who claimed to be female. I was sort of surprised to see that most people write like men. This sort of startled me. I mean, the big question is, why are there so many people in virtual drag? I looked over a good number of the hundreds of entries, and what I found is there's three things really going on. First, women do not use blogs the same way that men do. A lot of women include stories or essays or news articles or editorials. And that's a formal writing style. That's not an informal style. A lot of them also attribute text to male authors or to friends who test as male. But then again, some people are just not female. To give you a couple of examples, here's a blog entry by PsychoBitch. PsychoBitch claims to be female, and her blog entries, not just this one, all of them, test as though she writes like a female. In all likelihood, PsychoBitch is what she claims to be. In contrast, there's Ashley. Ashley claims to be female, and yet her writing style looks like a male. This doesn't mean that Ashley is a guy. It just means she writes like a guy. And then there's Samantha G. Samantha G claims to be female. She also claims to be 100 years old. Her writing styles, not just this one, all of them, are strongly weighted as male. I feel really sorry for all the guys who write into her on her blog and who chat with her, saying how much they love her and how much they want to meet her, because, you know, they're probably writing to a guy. But the more common example are people like Aaliyah. Aaliyah claims to be female, yet her writing style looks like a male. If you take a close look at her blog entry, and it's a real long blog entry, there's really only one sentence that's written by her. Everything else is attributed to someone named Michael Berg. Michael writes like a guy. And if you take a closer look, it's a news article. It's not a blog entry. That's a formal writing style, not an informal writing style. So if you're interested in playing with things like the gender guesser, I've actually released this tool publicly. Just go to hackerfactor.com and click on forensics. You'll see the link to the gender guesser. And all you do is you paste your text in there and click analyze, and the results will appear right below it. The entire thing's written in JavaScript, so you can actually view the source code. And that takes us on to our second category, author analysis. Author analysis allows us to determine if two writing samples were written by the same person. Back in January 1996, the book Primary Colors came out, and it was written by Anonymous. For those of you who aren't familiar with the book, it's a farcical view of a presidential campaign, but it was clearly written by an insider of the Bill Clinton administration. By February, everyone wanted to know who was Anonymous. One researcher, a guy named Don Foster, came up with a novel approach. You see, the words we use and the vocabulary that we have is distinct to us. And so he just did a couple of heuristics. He looked at things like the core words, the vocabulary size that's used, the punctuation frequency, sentence length, word usage, parts of speech, hyphenated words, made up words, spelling errors, grammar differences, and so on. And he identified a probable author. In February 1996, Don Foster identified Joe Klein as being the author of Primary Colors. Even though he identified him in February, it wasn't until July that Joe Klein actually admitted to being the author. Now, I don't know the full details of the approach that Don Foster used, and since I needed a similar approach, I had to recreate it myself. And this is how it works. You start with a writing sample. In this case, I'm using Mark Rosch. Among other things, he's a columnist for Security Focus, and that means we have lots of writing samples. And then we can do things like make a histogram of the distinct words that he uses. In this writing sample, there were over 3,700 words, of which almost 8% of them were the word the. He has a strong central core of words that he constantly uses. He then has a small secondary cord in blue of words that he also depends on. If we compare this with another writing sample of his, we can see that his primary core really doesn't change. And in fact, most American English speakers use the same primary core. His secondary core varies between 3 and 5 words. And those words in green, forensics, computers, government, that's the topic of his writing. So he repeats his subject enough times to get it up into his secondary core. Now we can compare Mark against someone like Scott Greneman, who's another columnist at Security Focus. And I'm just going to put them side by side here. And what we see is, although they use pretty much the same primary core, Mark has a larger secondary core. Mark uses around 5 words, Scott uses 1 or 2. And Mark repeats the subject enough to get into the secondary core. Scott doesn't. Now, these writing samples are roughly the same size, but Scott uses many more distinct words. What that means is that Scott has a larger vocabulary than Mark. If we compare them based on punctuation, what we see is that Scott uses a colon more often than Mark does, but Mark really likes his parentheses, hyphens, and quotations. And if we look at sentence lengths, in that first writing sample I showed you, Mark has 3 sentences that contain 49 words each. Mark likes long sentences. Scott, on the other hand, is more likely to use something in the 30s range, while Mark isn't. And Mark likes the upper 20s, while Scott likes the lower 20s. Mark also likes to hit a couple of sentence lengths repeatedly. Usually it's around 13 words and 20 words. Now, different writing samples will be off by a little bit, so it could be 19, 20, or 21, for example. But he's going to hit 1 sentence length repeatedly. Scott, on the other hand, likes to vary his sentences. He doesn't hit one particular length. So how do you use author analysis? The information's not unique enough to identify an author, so you can't say that these 2 writings are by the same person. But you can use it to rule someone out. Don Foster didn't actually come out initially and say Joe Klein was anonymous. He came out and said, of the 12 suspects he has, it's not these 11. The systems work best when there's multiple samples, preferably on similar topics and with similar word counts. But the accuracy varies depending on the approach you use. Punctuation comparisons, for example, are very accurate and are very forgiving if you have different topics and different sentence writing sample lengths. Whereas sentence lengths are less accurate and more sensitive to word count. What can you get out of author analysis? We can determine things like nationality and their native language. For example, if they're American, they're likely to have a small vocabulary, and that means a small core of words. If they're European, they're going to have a large vocabulary, and they're either going to have a large core of words, or they may not even have a distinguishable core. If you graph the words, the distinct word usage on a histogram, for Americans, you'll see a nice sharp curve coming down. For Europeans, you'll either see a broad curve, or in smaller samples, a straight line. You can also identify co-authors. If 2 paragraphs have very different styles, or 2 sections, or 2 chapters, then you know that they were likely written by different people. And we can expand this to analyze source code. Because the comments the people use, the line lengths, variable name, and so on, are distinct attributes. So to give you an example, let's take a close look at FatBot. I assume everyone here knows what FatBot is, big worm, lots of variations of it. FatBot actually came from Agobot, and it's also known under a bunch of names. There's Galbot, Nornbot, Polybot, dozens of others. The family first appeared around October 2002. Since that time, many different variations of the source code have been released, and each of those variations contain comments and documentation. Those are writing samples. Now, I need to point out that on May 7, 2004, an author was actually arrested and accused of being the sole author of Agobot. What you probably didn't hear is that at the same time, 5 other people were also charged, but there's no mention of who they are or whether or not they were actually convicted. I actually analyzed 2 different versions of the source code. I looked at what's called the Agobot private version. The Agobot source code was dated October 2003, and then I looked at a later version called the FatBot current version, which was dated March 2004. And if we just take a look at a couple of files that are actually found in FatBot, what we'll see is, for example, on utility CPP, it uses C++-style comments, whereas Harvest CD Keys uses ANSI C-style comments. There's also differences in the use of tabs, indentation, spaces. Are there spaces around equal signs? Does code start on the same line as the new scope, or does it start on the next line down? And so on. These are distinct attributes for the programmer. Based on these, we can determine that these two files were likely created by two different people. The other nice thing about the FatBot distribution is that it actually includes the source code control files. Using these, we can tell what nickname checked in what code. Now, not every piece of code has a nickname associated with it, so we don't know who edited all the code. But what we can tell is, based on similar programming styles, who modified which files. And doing this, we can see that FatBot had at least 7 authors. But wait, there was Ago who was arrested, as well as 5 other people charged. That's 6. So what happened to the 7th person? In any case, let's take a close look at one guy. This is Nils. According to the file control structure, Nils checked in a file called radminscanner.cpp. And if we take a look at the header for radminscanner.cpp, we can see that it's the radmin mass router, and it's by Nils, nils@rbot.org. This is great. We have an email address. We can search Google for that email address, and there's really only one match that comes up, and I know this is hard to read, so here's the actual text on it. Nils@rbot.org wrote to AOL saying that his web server and IRC server were under a denial of service attack, and he wanted AOL to do something about it. He signed it Nils Wagner. So, great, now we have a name. His domain, rbot.org, is no longer online, but there is a copy of it at the Internet Archive's Wayback Machine. And if you take a look at it, you see another writing sample by Nils, and you can see a website that's devoted to bots, botnets, source code, and so on. I really like the survey along the right side. It says, what bots are you using? Rbot, Spybot, or Agobot private version? Well, gee, that's the version I'm analyzing. There's pretty much no argument that Nils is actually involved in this in some way, shape, or form. The other thing that really got my attention was this comment further down in the radmin scanner file. It says, my thanks go to Dave Adel for mentioning this to me. So I've looked all over the place in public forums to see if there's any conversations between Dave and someone named Nils, and unfortunately, there isn't any. But I did find a conversation between Dave and someone else talking about Unicode and multibyte source code. And that was between Dave and a guy named WirePair. This is the end of a long conversation, but WirePair basically says, here's my exploit, and you can actually go and download this today. The file is 0349.cpp. And if we look at 0349.cpp, we see the exact same comment. In fact, a lot of this code looks very familiar. What I'm going to do is I'm going to overlay the 0349 code with the radmin scanner code from FatBot. Watch very carefully. There is one variable change. Everything else, byte per byte, is identical. And it's not just this one small section of code, it's the entire file. Now, this isn't the first time WirePair's code has appeared in FatBot. WirePair wrote a piece of program called decomuni.c, which appears to be the basis for FatBot's decom2scanner.cpp. Again, this code was checked in by Nils according to the changes.txt file and is found in the older Agobot source code. The other interesting thing is that the decom2scanner has comments. Almost every line is annotated. If you're just going to take someone's source code and include it, you're probably not going to take the time to annotate every line. That's usually reserved for the developer. WirePair also wrote a file called rscbbrute.c, which seems to be the basis for wdsscanner.cpp, which is, again, found in both FatBot and Agobot. So this is great. Now we've got two suspects who appear to have contributed to Agobot. There's WirePair, who runs showdown.org. He's a C++ programmer. He likes Windows exploits. He lives in the New England area of the United States, or likely lives there. And according to WirePair's webpage, he works for one of the big 3 antivirus companies. Nils, on the other hand, could be Nils Wagner. But then again, that could be an alias. I mean, Emmanuel Goldstein from 2600, that's not his real name. Nils ran rbot.org. He was also known as nils@ryan1918.com. Ryan1918, before it was shut down, was another site devoted to botnets. And Nils has the same skill set as WirePair. So the big question is, is wire pair the same as Nils, or did Nils borrow wire pair's code? And to answer this, we use author analysis. You see, we have lots of writing samples by wire pair, and although Nils only has a few writing samples, we can still do a comparison. Like with punctuation. Things immediately stand out, like wire pair likes his commas, Nils doesn't. Nils likes parentheses, hyphens, but wire pair doesn't. These are distinctions in the writing. If we go through the entire exercise, what we find out is that wire pair has a dual core, 6 primary, 7 secondary, suggesting that he's an American. Nils, on the other hand, has no noticeable core. This could mean that the samples are too short, or it could mean that he's European. Either way, we can call it inconclusive. Sentence lengths, wire pair likes 7 to 27 words, possibly up to 40. Nils only has short sentences, but then again, there's few samples, so we can also call that inconclusive. But for punctuation, there are distinct differences. These are likely different people. So to summarize, Nils is unlikely the same person as wire pair because they have different writing styles. What probably happened is that wire pair wrote standalone exploits and released them on his site. Nils had been watching wire pair for at least 6 months and probably more like a year. Whenever wire pair released anything interesting, Nils would borrow the code and adapt it to work in FatBot and Agobot. Now, there's no evidence that Nils and WirePair ever communicated. WirePair may not even be aware that his code appears as the basis for Agobot. Now, there is a quick follow-up about this, and that's, I mentioned on May 7th, 2004, Alex G was arrested in Germany and charged with writing Agobot. Shortly afterwards, rbot.org and Ryan1918 were taken offline. About a month and a half later, I found a blog entry that says that rbot.org was taken down because Nils and Ago had both been taken into custody. But I could find no official word on whether Nils was actually taken into custody, charged, or convicted. What I do know is he pretty much vanished for a year. After about a year, someone appeared using the name Nils and associated with the name Nils Wegner. This person works on massively multiplayer online role-playing games. He lives in Hamburg, Germany, and his webpage layout looks very similar to rbot.org, but then again, that could be due to a template. It's important to note that this may not be the same person. It's very possible that there are two people named Nils Wegner out there in the world. Besides, the guy I'm looking for plagiarizes source code, and this second Nils Wegner has only been publicly accused in a forum of copying graphics into his game. And that takes us onto keyboard profiling, or as I like to call it, how to read gibberish. I'm sure you've all seen times when people just sort of bang on the keyboard. This is when there's, for example, a web page with a web entry form, and the only way to get past it is to type in something even though you don't care what the value is. You'll see it for usernames, accounts, email addresses, stuff like that, where people just don't want to enter in information. You also see it in IRC, chat rooms, instant messaging, and so on, where it can indicate frustration, where someone just bangs on the keyboard out of anger. Or a demonstration like, and then you just type in something and they bang on the keyboard. Or to get someone's attention, they'll bang on the keyboard and say, "Are you awake?" What you end up with are some random characters like the ones at the bottom. The problem is, these were created by a human, and therefore, they are not random. They can be used to determine things like whether or not someone's left or right-handed. The way we determine that, when a person has to do two different tasks with their hands, with both hands, the dominant hand performs the easier task. You see this a lot in musical instruments. A guitar, for example, is a right-handed instrument. The right hand is doing the easy task. It's strumming the strings. The left hand's doing the complicated chords, putting the right finger in the right place at the right time. So all of the musician's focus is put on the right hand. Sorry, on the left hand. Same thing with the violin, viola, cello, and so on. The bow is complicated, but it's not as hard as doing the chords. And a banjo, it's held the other way. While the dominant hand, the right hand, is doing the chords, and they are complicated, it's not as difficult as doing the picking, which is more complicated, so that's done by the left hand. So if you have to use the keyboard and mouse at the same time, the question is, which one's easier? Well, the mouse is easier because you just have to move something around. It's not putting a finger in a specific place on a specific key. So if you have to use both at the same time, the dominant hand is going to be on the mouse. The other thing to remember is that repetition creates speed. The hand that spends more time on the keyboard gets more practice, and therefore, if you have to put both hands on the keyboard and bang out keys, the other hand, not the dominant hand, will generate more keys. So we can actually graph these keys onto a keyboard. If someone bangs out some random characters like U, J, K, L, so on, we can see that most of these keys come from the right-hand side of the keyboard. Since they're from the right-hand side of the keyboard, the dominant hand's most likely on the left-hand side of the keyboard, or on the left, and it's on the mouse. Since the left hand's on the mouse, that makes the left hand dominant. Now, left-right determination is only about 70% accurate, and it really requires some additional information. You see, if you're a game player, a graphics designer, or a programmer, then you're probably more likely to use the mouse and keyboard at the same time. And that emphasizes the stress of the non-dominant hand being on the keyboard. On the other hand, external factors can also play a big part. If you're just using the computer for typing, email, chat room, so on, and you rarely use the mouse, then your dominant hand spends more time on the keyboard, and therefore it gets more practice. That reverses the determination. External factors like left or right keyboard and can vary based on left or right-handed. If you're left-handed, there's chances are really good that you're doing other things with your right hand. For example, you may write your name with your left hand but use scissors with your right. By the same means, you may be a left-handed person but use the computer like a right-handed person. Other things like carpal tunnel and physical injuries can also throw off the determination. Finger drumming, on the other hand, is much more accurate. The way we drum our fingers, whether it's from outside in or inside to out, is distinct. So I want to do a little group experiment. If everyone could take their left hand and put it on the desk in front of them like they're typing on a keyboard, and then type out the letters ASDF, that's pinky, ring finger, middle finger, index finger. It's an outside to in motion. Just type it repeatedly, ASDF, ASDF. Come on, I want to hear drumming. Yeah. Now try going the other direction. FDSA, FDSA. What you see is that one direction is smoother, easier, faster, and the other direction is more difficult, slower, clumsier, harder. Try doing the same thing with your other hand, your right hand. And you should see that you're probably symmetrical. Most people are. So both hands either go outside in or inside out. Everyone know which direction they go? Head nods? Okay. Let's do a quick survey. If you're symmetrical, that is your hands go from outside to in, symmetrical outside to in, so both hands go outside to in, can you raise your hands? This should be most of the room, about 70%, and I see a lot of hands coming up. Great. If you're symmetrical inside to out, raise your hand, should be about 30% of the room, and I see a couple of hands coming up. Good, you are my people, I drum my fingers like you. Just so everyone knows, people who drum their fingers from inside to out are far more intelligent than people... Just kidding. There should be a very small percentage of people who are asymmetrical. Raise your hands. One, two, three. Wonderful. Leave your hands up if you're... Oh, sorry. Take your hands down if you are a musician. One hand stays up. Yep. Two hands. Most people who are asymmetrical are... You can put your hands down. Thanks for playing. Most people who are asymmetrical are because they, Most people who are asymmetrical are because they play a musical instrument or have done some other type of task that overcomes their natural tendencies. Now, there's one other category, and that's people who don't drum their fingers. I'm not going to ask them to raise their hands, and I've only come across four of them so far, but people who cannot drum their fingers, so both directions are slow and clumsy, usually have attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. How do you determine finger drumming direction? You just map the keys onto the keyboard. In this case, the string has a FDSA type pattern and a JKL type pattern, suggesting inside to out drumming. So this person's symmetrical inside to out. The other thing to remember is that adjacency creates speed. If you take the black hat call for paper paragraph that I showed you and map it onto a keyboard, what we see is that the most common characters, the ones in red, are all over the place on a regular keyboard. The ones in yellow, the second most common characters, are also pretty much all over the place. And that's because a standard QWERTY keyboard is not made for speed. A Dvorak keyboard, on the other hand, is designed for speed. And the same characters map out to be pretty much adjacent. And this is because it takes more time to move the fingers between the different rows. We can use this to determine the type of keyboard that they're using. For example, if we map this random keyboard banging onto a keyboard, we see that it's pretty much in a straight line on a standard flat QWERTY keyboard. But on a Dvorak keyboard, it's all over the place. So the person who typed this is probably using a QWERTY keyboard and not a Dvorak. When people bang out random characters, they're usually doing it fast. They're not doing it slowly. And so the speed allows us to determine the keyboard type. We can also determine things like ergonomics. You see, if the person's sitting the right distance away from the keyboard, their hand should land on the middle row. That's the ASDF row, the home row. If they're sitting too close to the keyboard or the keyboard's too low, their fingers are more likely to land on the upper rows. This is common for a laptop. And if the keyboard's too far away or too high, then they're more likely to use the lower rows. So from keyboard profiling, we can determine things like whether someone's left or right-handed, how they drum their fingers, the type of keyboard that they use, the keyboard's ergonomic location, whether or not they're a musician, and much more. This is almost as good as blood splatter to a criminologist. The next time you go into an IRC chat room, where people are trading stolen credit cards and stolen IDs, remember keyboard profiling. Because even though every one of those hosts are probably a compromised server or some type of anonymous proxy system, you can still determine something about the individual. Like Ander, third one from the top, he's left-handed. The guy who uses the nickname Away in the middle, he's right-handed and uses an adjustable ergonomic keyboard that's currently set at about an 80-degree angle. Those four guys at the bottom, War, Credit Card Shop, and Azurdi, yeah, they're using French keyboards. What are the chances of someone using a French keyboard if they're not French? And the guy at the very top, QFWUUU, yeah, he's a left-handed German, and since he's playing with the top row, he's likely using a laptop. Now, that's not the only way that we can use keyboard profiling. Let me show you another way of doing it. This is a group that I call called themselves the Dutch Mafia. And no, I did not misspell that. I'm sure you've all seen phishing emails before. Dear Citibank customer, there's something wrong with your account. Please click on this link and to do something about it. Well, this, as a phishing email goes, is a pretty bad one, because not only did it have links to the real Citibank, it also had links to Wells Fargo. But if you didn't notice that, and you clicked on the link, it says that it would take you to Citibank's login page, but it actually took you to a place called inoutrequestinformation.com. Inoutrequestinformation.com is registered to someone called Patrick Howard the Untouchable. Now, the domain itself, although it's hosted at Yahoo, the particular host that was used to do the scam, was it located somewhere else? It was located on Husting the Untouchable. This term, the Untouchable, appears in a lot of the domain registrations. What we're looking at here is someone signing their work so they can point at their friends and say, look, see that? I did it. In fact, all the servers from this group are configured consistently. They're all running some type of an Apache web server, and they have open directories. So if you actually go to the directory, you'll see all the files that are there. There's no index file. And based on the file naming convention and the contents of the file, we can tell that they were mirrored using Mozilla or Firefox, the save as command. They were not mirrored using Internet Explorer or wget, and we can tell that because of the naming convention, the fact that there's no odd line wraps at 100 characters, and there's no dots carriage return line feeds. I went through my collection of phishing archives, phishing sightings that I've archived, and looked for different servers that had these same attributes. And what I found was a large collection of them. You can see that the group started around January 14th, 2005. They built up in volume over time, and Then around July 2005, they dropped off in volume, stopping completely in October 2005. We can also see that the group targets, although they like eBay and Citibank, they go after a lot of different targets. Most fishers target one bank and then move on to the next and then move on to the next. This group's all over the place. And there's no date consistency. They can skip days or weeks at a time. Most fishers and spammers are consistent. They operate on a schedule. So those are some inconsistencies that stand out. Another inconsistency comes from the email headers. Here's one, it's a big email header. Here's another, it's smaller. A third one, it's different. And a fourth one that's tiny. Spammers use tools, and tools act consistently. They'll have the same types of headers in the same order every time. Spammers also don't change their tools until their tools become ineffective. But here's a group who's changing their tools between almost every single mass mailing. So what's going on? Are they actually changing their tools? The answer is no, they're changing their spammers. What we're looking at is a chaotic organization where there's a bunch of individuals who perform a single task. A leader will gather around all the different people that he needs to do all the different tasks, and then they'll do the mass mailing. That's how phishings go out. The reason I call it a chaotic organization is I use chaotic in a mathematical sense. In mathematics, a chaotic point is random, but a bunch of points are well organized. In this case, a single individual is stupid, but together they are brilliant. The untouchable has this very specific skill set in this organization. This person or group compromises servers, configures the servers, and on some occasions develops their own scams. The reason the targets vary so dramatically is because someone else is coming up with the target. The reason their dates vary dramatically is because sometimes they've got a job, sometimes they don't. And the reason their mailing lists and their spam headers look different is because someone else is doing the mass mailing, not them. So I looked all over for a person or a group or a team that goes by the name The Untouchable and has the right skill sets. And I found a lot of people who play Unreal Tournament who go by the name The Untouchable, but none of them really had the right skill set. Only one person really stood out. This is someone who's a member of the Dutch Mafia. He calls himself The Untouchable. And I mentioned that they stopped spamming in October 2005. This guy stopped attending the forum in September 2005, 1 month earlier. The Dutch Mafia themselves ran a web server as well as a bunch of IRC servers that were devoted to movie swapping, porn, and wares. They also did a little bit of carding, but really not much. As far as the staff members go, the Untouchable is listed as one of the staff members. If we take a look at some of the channel topics that have been used on their IRC servers, we can see a request for routers and scanners. Scanners are people who look for systems to compromise, and routers actually compromise them. That's compartmentalized functionality. That's what we'd expect to see in a chaotic organization. And by the way, if you're interested in talking about bots, you can contact The Untouchable. But the best part of all this, since we have a good suspect, we'd like to know more about this person. He actually did a posting and gave a physical location, date, and time where he would be. He was setting up a meeting for all of his friends. Unfortunately, we couldn't get our act together fast enough. We knew about this before it happened, but not by enough time, so we couldn't get someone there with a camera. But if we did, how would you pick out The Untouchable out of a crowd anyway? To do that, we used keyboard profiling. You see, The Untouchable gave us a writing sample. According to this writing sample down here, The Untouchable is right-handed, which narrows him down to 70% of the population, and he has asymmetrical drumming. That's less than 5% of the population. It also indicates that he's probably a musician of some kind. In fact, he plays the guitar. He's less than 5% of 70% is 3.5%, so if 100 people appeared at this meeting place, we could probably narrow him down to about one of four people. And if less than 25 people were to show up, he's probably distinct. So to wrap up this group, the Dutch Mafia focused on system compromises and configuration. They were into file swapping, primarily wares, porn, music, and video. And they dabbled in phishing as part of the chaotic phishing group. Now, I need to point out that that the domain DutchMafia.org is no longer active, and their IRC servers have been down since at least May 2006. As far as the untouchable goes, he's no longer phishing. He stopped in October 2005. And he's not active in the web forum. He stopped in September 2005. And I was never able to actually observe him on IRC, so he could have been using a different nick, or I could have just been consistently missing him. In any case, we do know that he's right-handed, and he has asymmetrical drumming, and is likely a musician. So when I talk about keyboard profiling, there's a couple of techniques that people always try to mention, and I just want to shoot them down now because they really don't work. Studies have shown that the way we type is unique. The typing pressure that we use when we push down on the keys, the speed between keys, the speed for pushing down versus releasing, all of those are distinct attributes. That makes it great for a biometric authentication system. But there's a problem, because IRC, instant messaging, email, and other online forms don't convey a sense of speed or pressure. If you don't have the information, you can't use this. So it's a good idea in theory, but it's poor for this type of forensics and profiling. The other is how to determine someone's age from their vocabulary. You see, some words are generation-specific, like neat, neato, cool, bad, rad, wicked, the bomb. But in online forums, people influence each other. Words that are used by one person are frequently used by other people. So if you get into a chat room and you use the word rad, other people are going to probably start using the word rad just to blend in. There's also problems with cut and paste. When people are in two different forums, they constantly take text from one chat room and paste it into the window of another. You can't tell whose text is actually by the original author. And then there's problems with translation systems because you're not looking at the author's original words. So to wrap up this talk, investigative sciences have been around for a very long time, but computers are a relatively new field. As a result, there's few forensics and profiling tools available, and the ones that are focus primarily on collection, system analysis, and network analysis. What this means is that there are plenty of opportunities for new techniques. As far as anonymity goes, anonymity can protect you to a degree, but you need to be careful about what you expose, because techniques such as gender analysis, author analysis, and keyword profiling can identify physical attributes about you. I'm sure you're all familiar with the famous New Yorker cartoon, "On the Internet, Nobody Knows You're a Dog," but they can't tell if you're a left-handed female piano player with an ergonomic keyboard. I've got a little bit of time left. Are there any questions? No questions? I'm Neil Krautz. I'm with Hacker Factor Solutions, and I'm available for consulting, weddings, and bar mitzvahs. Thank you very much for your time.